Today on Off Mic, we're celebrating athletics as the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games wind up. We'll hear about the late, great Diane Durham of Gary, the African-American senior national gymnastics champion, and how she paved the way for many of today's superstar athletes. Along with the 2020 Olympics, 2021 has become the year of seeing sports psychology in action. What does it mean and what should we make of it? Gary has a long history in professional and amateur boxing. We'll talk with one of the Steel City's boxing world champions. And if the Olympic Games inspire you to do more, you're not alone. We'll talk about how the international sports celebration inspires our local athletes. All of this coming up on Off Mic. And welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Gonzalez, and I'm in for Michael Puente. Over the last few Summer Olympic Games, I've been really excited to see so much more racial and ethnic diversity in so many sports. And I see it a lot in U.S. women's gymnastics. Athletes like Lori Hernandez and Gabby Douglas, Sunisa Lee, and Simone Biles have redefined the sport in the U.S., but they can all thank trailblazers like Lucy Collins, Dominique Dawes, Kyla Ross, and one special person I'd like to talk about today, and that's Gary's own Diane Durham. Tom Jehosal is joining us. He's a high school principal, coach, and the husband of Diane Durham, who helped change the face of gymnastics in 1983 when she became the first African-American woman to win the U.S. National Gymnastics Championship. A year later, Diane was denied a spot at the 1984 Olympic team due to injury and a controversial ruling on her petition to be included on the U.S. team. This year, she was posthumously inducted into U.S. Gymnastics Hall of Fame. She went on to become a professional gymnastics performer, a coach, a motivational speaker, and a gym owner. Unfortunately, Diane passed away in February after a brief illness. She was 52. Tom Drohosal, thank you for joining us on Off Mic. First, my condolences to you and your loved ones.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you for joining us. Today marks your 27th anniversary, yours and Diane, and I know it takes a tremendous amount of courage and love to share her story this way.
Yeah, it does, but I do think it's of value for Diane's story to be told so future generations realize the impact she had on the sport of gymnastics.
And it's an amazing story, Tom, but before we begin, I have to ask you, I'm curious, how does a high school teacher meet and marry a trailblazing world-class athlete like Diane Durham?
Well, Diane had just finished performing. Diane did get to the Olympics, a little bit different path than she expected to. She performed in the closing ceremonies of the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. So she, on that flight back, she'd been doing a lot of professional dance shows. She'd been all over the world. She'd been in Spain with Barcelona for that. She'd been to Japan, and she'd been in Germany for different shows. And on the way back, she told me she had decided she was looking to settle down. She was kind of tired of the dance audition life of, you know, it's pretty much, you know, you're here today, and then once that show goes, it's find the next show. So she said on the way back, she decided she was going to settle down. She took a gymnastics coaching job in Chicago at the time. And so I met her when we were both out one night, and then, you know, 6 months after we met, we got engaged. A year and a half later, we were married.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. And she was very busy, and she had a lot of titles. I mean, she earned her titles and accolades. For all those titles, what do you think, what title or accomplishment do you think she cherished the most?
I mean, I think of all the gymnastics-wise, there were two meets, or there were actually three big meets to her that stuck out. One was, of course, winning senior USA all-around championship in Chicago, because it was so close to Gary, where she grew up. Mm-hmm. And the fan base from Gary that turned out for that event, I think that really meant a lot to her as well. That's something she always talked about. 1983, also, she competed in what was the pre-Olympic Games, which were in Los Angeles in Pauley Pavilion, where those games would be held in 1984, and she won the all-around championship in that competition, and she beat gymnasts from Soviet bloc countries who would later boycott the 1984 Olympics.
So and those videos.
The last one to her was the Sanlam Cup in South Africa in 1981, where she won the all-around championship during apartheid in South Africa. That was her first international trip.
These are all so amazing. I really enjoy watching the videos, by the way. And there are these large "We Love Diane" signs that they're holding up in the stands. It was just such a fantastic and energizing moment.
Yeah, it was. And that was from her church back in Gary, actually, that people did that.
So Gary came out. So I know that growing up, for me anyways, it was rare, as I mentioned a moment ago, to see people of color competing on U.S. teams in a whole lot of sports. That's clearly changing. And I think Diane's accomplishments had a lot to do with that. So how did Diane see gymnastics over the last few years, especially when you compare it to gymnastics when she was growing up?
Well, that's true. Gymnastics, there was more artistry involved in it today than there was back in Diane's era than it is today. In the scoring system, it was a 10 scoring system, and today there's a reward for difficulty, you know, plus artistry type of execution as well. So it is different from what it used to be in her era. I do feel, a lot of people have said the same thing, that between Diane and Mary Lou Retton, they kind of introduced, power gymnastics to not only the United States, but later to the world as well.
Now, I think, isn't it the case also that Diane was the last person to beat Mary Lou Retton in an all-around competition?
Yes, she was. Yeah, and that was at those pre-Olympic games in 1983.
And by the way, in one of those videos, I'm watching Diane do the uneven bars, and she hits her left ankle. I think it was her left or right ankle, but she hit one of her ankles on the bars. And she just continued. She carried on, and when she was being interviewed afterwards, she said, "Oh no, it's not really a problem. It's not an injury. Not really an injury." Even though Bella Caroli is kind of massaging out that injury, so it speaks to her toughness.
It does, and then because she did tell me what I know. I'm not the gymnastics expert, but I remember that move. She told me she would hit her heel a lot on the bars, so that was something she had kind of gotten accustomed to, because the bars were much closer together mm-hmm. back in that era than they are today as well.
So we talk about how gymnastics and other sports have changed. What's it going to take? So what do you think it'll take to get more young boys and girls of color into and competing at such high level of gymnastics and other sports? Clearly, when you have trailblazers like Diane Durham, that's got to be a big help. But what else is it going to take?
Well, I mean, definitely it takes, as far as there's got to be an investment in at the ground level, in communities across the United States to get kids into gymnastics. It's an expensive sport. That's part of the problem. So in the inner cities, there's got to be the cities, have to help finance through park district type programs or getting people, to contribute to introduce gymnastics in urban areas, I think would be a big plus to it. Obviously, from Diane's era, however, the amount of minority gymnasts competing in the sport has grown dramatically, though, too. And that's something you can see at all different levels. And when I would go along to Diane with meets, when she was either judging or had gymnasts competing, you did see there was much more of a diverse look in the program as far as the junior Olympic competitions that she was judging or coaching in.
I want to talk a little bit more, especially about the financial accessibility of this sport. But it strikes me, as you and Diane were traveling and you go to different places, you just had to be just surrounded by people who wanted to just talk to her and kind of have a moment with her and just show her some love. Tell me about those moments.
Well, definitely when at gymnastics competitions or conferences, definitely, Diane was very, people did recognize her. So, and that was always something that she did appreciate, that people still remembered her contribution to the sport, so many years after she had competed. So that was something that, did stick with her, and it did make her realize that she did make a difference in the sport as well.
Is there a particular moment that touched you in one of those times? Is there something that really grabs your attention even now?
The one thing that would happen is kind of she couldn't understand why little gymnasts sometimes would always remember who she was or ask her for her autograph or want to take a picture with her. And then because she would tell me that as we were, leaving the venue or walking back to the hotel, and I would always tell her, Diana said, you have to remember, I said, those parents, the parents of those gymnasts are the ones that remember who you are. And then that would kind of click into her and let her realize that, obviously she made an impact on those parents so much that, they're pointing her out to their children as well.
So when you when you meet people and they find out you're married to Diane, and what are some of the ways you describe her? How do you describe her? Because, I mean, 27 years, it's a long time. 27 years is a long time. What's sort of the first things that come out of your heart and your mind when you think about describing Diane?
Well, I mean, gymnastics-wise, she loved gymnastics. And even though she felt at times the gymnastics, some of the powers to be in the gymnastics world didn't love her as much as she loved the sport. She always loved gymnastics. That was kind of an undying love that she had. Outside of gymnastics, I mean, definitely, I mean, she had a very charismatic, outgoing personality. You know, when Diane may have been small in stature, she was, you know, 5'1", but when she walked in a room, everybody knew, you know, Diane Durham was in the room.
Sure.
I mean, she definitely had a very bubbly, energetic, positive personality.
So if we come back to talking a little bit about gymnastics and how expensive it is, it really is. I mean, people move across country to train. So even if you get communities involved, how does this sport become more financially accessible to more people?
Well, I think once you get to the elite level, I mean, Diane left Gary to go train in Texas with Bella Caroli, you know, and she did that in 1982, I believe. So, I mean, it is kind of, you know, there are pockets when you want to get to that elite level, you know, there's certain gyms that you end up having to go to, because Diane's gymnastics career started at Wanda's gym in Gary. And then Wanda later moved to Merrillville, but then Wanda Tomasi, and then Wanda basically, when Diane got to such a high level, Wanda told Diane, you know, I can no longer coach you. You're an Olympic caliber athlete, which, you know, hats off to Wanda for saying that, you know, instead of trying to,
right.
you know, and so that was a huge thing. And then after that, Diane was traveling into Illinois all the way up to like Northbrook to train or into the southwest suburbs, I mean, so it was quite a commute for her, you know, 5-6 days a week to go to basically after school, you know, get in the car with her mom, and then, you know, she'd go work out and then come back home at night.
That's just an incredible commitment and sacrifice.
By her and her family both.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And speaking of
her dad's
family.
Listening today, so, I mean, he definitely had a role in it.
Well, hi, Dad. We're just honored to be able to talk about Diane Durham today on Off Mic. So, Tom Drahosa, tell me about the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award.
Okay, that is something. It's a GoFundMe that started under the GoFundMe. If you look up Diane Durham Humanitarian Award, it was started by Paul Zert, actually. Paul Zert was Bart Conner's former coach. He is now his business manager and with Nadia Comaneci as well. Diane performed in, you know, hundreds of gymnastics professional shows with Paul Zert and Bart Conner and then Nadia Comaneci as well. And so they remained friends, you know, all the way up until Diane's passing. So Diane knew them, you know, from the basically from 1980 all the way up until, you know, for over 40 years. And Paul wanted this way to honor Diane, to preserve her legacy, so people would know about her and future generations would as well. And the idea behind this, and Diane's sister Alice and myself are going to be, you know, we're involved with that and on the board of directors and helping to, you know, select who the winners will be, is to honor a gymnast who has kind of had to overcome, you know, some issues in their life, whether it's injuries or social emotional issues, and they would be the recipient of the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award. We want to make this an annual award as well. It's already raised over $30,000.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, so we're hoping to continue to see that number continue to grow so we can, you know, so their awards every year could be bigger, but also so we can continue to grow this award as well.
And so where do folks go if they want more information or if they want to contribute?
If you want to contribute, you just literally, if you do a search for the Diane Durham Humanitarian Award, it's a GoFundMe link, and it'll take you right to it.
So real quick, we've just got about a minute and a half or so, but you're a basketball coach and a baseball coach. You've earned your chops as a coach. Real quick, what traits do you see in young people that stand out to you and you can say, hey, that kid's got some talent? You've been working with kids for a long time.
Yes, I have. The biggest thing you see is, you know, the inner drive themselves. You know, you as a coach can try and pull things out of a student, out of an athlete, but which is helpful, but they've also got to want to have that drive as well. And when they have that, you can see some wonderful things take place.
Well, you know, that with great coaching helps a lot, too. So, that Tom Drahozoff, you've been extremely generous with your time. Thank you for sharing this wonderful story with us on Off Mic.
And I appreciate you taking the time to recognize Diane as well.
It's really my honor and my pleasure. Thank you very much. So we will be right back with more on Off Mic. And earlier this year, welcome back, by the way, to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Gonzalez. So earlier this year, tennis superstar Naomi Osaka got plenty of press when she refused to talk with the press after the French Open, and she cited mental health concerns. The most decorated gymnast of all time, the GOAT, so to speak, the greatest of all time, Simone Biles, she literally removed herself from the U.S. women's gymnastics team competition, the all-around competition, and most of the individual events. She also cited mental health concerns. So Dr. Troy Moses, a clinical and sports psychologist in his second season as director of counseling and sports psychology at Indiana University. He's worked in a number of capacities at the universities of Minnesota, Missouri, North Texas, and McAllister College. Dr. Troy Miles, welcome to Off Mic.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. First, I have to ask, how does someone with a bachelor's degree in psychology and computer science become a very busy sports psychologist?
That's a good question. I was actually just talking with some staff and recruit about this sort of my past. I feel like I'm on repeat now. But yeah, so you could start out going into the field, undergrad, or getting into sports science or kinesiology or that kind of thing. And then sort of from there, you really need to go that graduate school route. And for myself, going through a master's program and then a doctoral program where, you know, I got specialized training as a counseling psychologist and then with sports psychology as an emphasis, sort of the road that I went.
So, and this is an interesting time, by the way, because I'm a sports fan, especially the older I get. So if 2020, I kind of think of 2020 as a year of COVID-19 in sports, 2021 is probably going to be the year that we really learn a lot more about sports psychology. But really, what is sports psychology?
Yeah, so sports psychology, I mean, if we sort of want to go to the book, so to speak, and look at as a field how it's defined, really what it is, it's the study of how participation in sport affects someone's mental health. And then also looking at how a performer or an athlete's mental health or mental skills training or mindset training affects their performance in sport. So really that it's looking at that bi-directional relationship and interaction between an athlete or performer's mental health and their participation in sport. But if you think about it more broadly and sort of how it's actually applied in practice, you know, the way that we talk about sports psychology is really we view mental health in general as just being on a spectrum or a continuum. And really sports psychology or people that are working in this field are able to work with performers really anywhere on that spectrum of mental health. And so on one end of the spectrum, from a mental health standpoint, we work with athletes who are coming in to meet with us about more significant concerns from a mental health standpoint. They might be debilitating to a certain degree. So things such as anxiety or depression or trauma or an eating disorder or something like that. And then as we slide along into the middle of that mental health spectrum, that's where we're talking with athletes about really the everyday concerns and things that are very normative in life that we all deal with at some point in time in our lives. So those are things such as managing stressors, and particularly with university-level athletes, managing transitions into school to being a Division I student athlete, the transition out of school or into the pros, that kind of thing, or relationship-related stressors, grief and loss, organizational or attentional skills, those types of things. And then as we slide along the to the right end of the mental health continuum, that's where we're going to get into more of the optimal mental health functioning for someone. And that's where we're teaching and talking with teams and individual athletes about performance enhancement, mental skills training. So mental skills training, mindset training, leadership training, things of that nature, really to take their game to the next level. And that's really, that optimal mental health area. And so I think there's some confusion out there as to when people talk about sports psychology, they tend to think of just the right end of that continuum. They think, well, it's just, you know, performance enhancement training or something like that. But really, the true field of sports psychology is all-encompassing of all mental health, that entire continuum, meeting a student athlete or an athlete or a performer where they're at on that continuum, and then helping them slide along that continuum towards the right end of the spectrum, towards that more optimal mental health.
So I'm really glad you brought up the sports spectrum, because it seems, at first glance, it seems really like a crowded spectrum. There's a lot to take in there. Before we go any further on that, though, I noticed that the U.S. women's volleyball team had a team sports psychologist that was at every game. That's got to be some indication of how seriously this is taken.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, especially at the Olympic level, they've taken it very seriously for actually a really long period of time, really for decades. From my understanding, the USOC, well, it's called the USOPC right now, but used to be the USOC, they were the first ones to really get into the field of sports psychology and hire, like, full-time sports psychologists to be on their staff, because they realized how important the mental aspect of performance was. And what they were finding was, at that high of a level of, you know, sport participation, that the true difference between someone who was really elite and, you know, a medalist contender, oftentimes what it came down to was the mental side of sport. And they were finding that oftentimes the mental side of things was really getting in the way from performers being able to, these Olympic level athletes, from being able to perform at their very best. And so they said, hey, we got to do something about this. And there's probably some things that we can learn about our athletes that's going on that's kind of blocking them to be able to perform at their best. And there's probably some skills that they can learn to help them be at their best as well in those most intense, most high pressure situations, i.e., the Olympic Games.
Yeah, that is really high pressure. So before we go any further, I have to ask you about the spectrum. So when I was growing up, I remember certain tennis stars kind of throwing rackets and throwing tantrums. I remember one particular NBA star who ran into an audience and got into a brawl, or got into the crowd and got into a brawl. And there have been other incidents. Is it fair to consider those events somewhere along that spectrum?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I hear things like that, my mind first goes to like anger management, and just being aware of one's own responses, internal responses and reactions to the situation that's going on outside of oneself. So yeah, I would actually say it's, you know, kind of a normative event. I mean, all of us probably have experienced at some point in our lives a time where it might not have been in sport per se, but you know, if it's happened in other areas of our lives, it's probably happened in sport as well. But there's times where we've kind of lost our cool and just been so frustrated at that situation, we've maybe said things that we didn't mean to say, or we've done things that we didn't otherwise mean to do. And then, you know, when our cooler head prevails, then we go back and say, you know what, ooh, maybe I wish I didn't do that. You know, maybe I could have handled things differently. And so I see that as a very normative type of thing, that, and something that we would talk through with our athletes about, like, hey, what was going on? What led up to this? Because typically it's not something where, you know, someone's throwing a racket like at the snap of a finger, right? Just one thing happens and they're throwing the racket or something. There's usually a series of events that lead up to that. Mm-hmm. And so working with our performers on understanding kind of the internal mental cues and triggers that lead up to more of that outburst of anger, it will help them more effectively learn how to manage and deal with it.
So I have to admit, so I told you I'm a sports fan. There was a time when I would have just kind of blown off sports psychology. Oh, yeah, go tell somebody else. Because if you think about it, we expect our world-class athletes to go through these tremendous amounts of stress and mental and emotional pressure. That's how you get to the elite level. Some of them even become really wealthy with endorsements. So if I'm one of these folks that's a little skeptical, so tell me why I would be concerned with an athlete's mental health. Why can't I just expect them to just go out and perform for us? That's what I'm paying to see.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I think when we as fans or spectators of sport and athletes, when we look through them through a certain lens, it sort of can dehumanize them or sort of separates them out from what's normal human experience in a way. So, you know, if someone says, yeah, I paid for this and I expect that they should be able to do X, Y, Z, we sort of take the human element
that
gets lost. And we sort of, there's an empathy, what we call like an empathy gap. And so there's not, there becomes a disconnect with seeing the athletes, you know, as performers, as like godlike figures, basically. So, you know, I think in our society in particular, that's how our society sort of treats our athletes. Like, you know, they're capable of these amazing, wonderful physical feats that most of us can't do. And so we look at them, we say, well, they can do that. And so we put them on this kind of pedestal. We say, well, because they can do that, then we sort of assume, or mistakenly assume, that, well, they should just be able to handle all the mental pressure and the expectations and the weight of, you know, an entire nation or even this little town on their shoulders to be able to perform in those moments. And I think it's really unfair to them. I think the more that we can shift our perspective to, like, these folks are human beings, and they might not have had the training on how to deal with, or they might not have had the mental skills on learning how to deal with adversity in certain situations or the expectations. I mean, how many people have been in Simone Biles' shoes where the weight of the entire Olympics media is
exactly
on her, or Michael Phelps? Like, you know, so who are we to come to them and say, you know, you should be able to do this? Like, well, what kind of support and what kind of skills did they learn to be able to manage those things? Those are things you just don't learn in school. Those are things you don't typically learn kind of in everyday life. So we just need to pay attention to those.
So after the Olympics, which is only a couple more days, and then, of course, we've got another Olympic Games coming up in a few months, Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
So after things have kind of calmed down, for a sports psychologist, would you say that what do you look forward to? Do you think that more people will think about our athletes more as humans instead of machines, and then also sports psychology, by being taken more seriously, will help more athletes?
I certainly hope so. I really do. I mean, I think the field of sports psychology in general has been growing especially over the last 5 to 10 years, because you're starting to see it not only at the Olympic levels, but we're at the pro levels and college levels and more in youth sports as we go along. And so I hope it just becomes more and more a part of the normal discourse now that we have more of these high profile athletes coming out and speaking about, hey, you know, I've been dealing with mental health issues, and like, this is something that we need to take seriously. My hope is that it will further destigmatize mental health with athletes in particular, because as we know, in general, mental health is sort of stigmatized in general, and then it's even more stigmatized in an athletic environment where, yeah, you are expected to, like you said, you know, be a machine, basically, to just suck it up, deal with it. You know, athletes oftentimes get those messages of, you know, just push through it,
right.
You know, suck it up, don't be a crybaby, all that kind of stuff. And it's an unhealthy message for them to get. And I think if we're able to approach them actually from a different caring and understanding standpoint, we'll actually probably see their performances in general become more consistent. And they will become better over time, as opposed to, you know, sort of putting them under the pressure gate of like, you have to perform and you should just be able to do this, and just automatically assume that they have this natural ability. You know, we need to help them and support them and help teach skills and all those kinds of things so they can be their best, the highest pressure moments.
So with a little bit of time left, but real quick, for those of us who are parenting young athletes and we want to be mindful of how to support those athletes, what is the number one thing we need to keep in mind to protect their mental health and to support them as parents? Your number one pointer for us.
I would say just listen to your kids and just try to approach them from a place of support and understanding, as opposed to they have to do things, or, you know, from your own agenda, like, oh, you know, I really need to get my, you know, kid hyper-specialized in a certain sport because I'm looking for that, you know, college scholarship, you know,
right,
15 years down the road or something like that. So really try to be mindful of what does my kid actually care about? What do they seem really interested in? And just supporting them in that and making sure that it's fun and then it doesn't become, you know, professionalized and so serious and all that kind of stuff. Making sure that they actually enjoy what they're doing and that they're doing it because they want to do it. They don't feel like they're being forced by a parent or some other outside entity.
Like a whole lot of Little League games I've seen over the years. Dr. Troy Moles of Indiana University, great tips,
yeah,
great discussion. We really appreciate you joining us on Off Mic.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for more Off Mic. Hey, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Gonzalez, and I'm in for Michael Puente. So one of my favorite places of all time, and a place where I spent a lot of time, is the Gary Police Athletic League Boxing Gym in North Gleason Park. So the legendary coach, John Taylor, who helped a lot of young people live a little bit better life. He really had the gym covered in all these really cool fight night posters and equipment and awards. And there were millions of newspaper articles yellow with age, including a few of mine, I have to admit, from when I was a newspaper reporter. So one day I'm in the ring training, and a pretty young girl comes from a nearby high school and decides to go into the gym with some of her girlfriends to see what was going on. And that visit really didn't go too well. But Mary McGee, she came back. Soon, that young woman became merciless Mary McGee, and now she is an amazing fighter and the International Boxing Federation's junior welterweight champion. Merciless Mary McGee, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mike.
It is a pleasure to have you, Merciless Mary McGee. You come from a long line of great fighters out of a great program, but there aren't that many women yet who have accomplished what you have. That's changing, of course. But at what point in your life did it finally hit you that you're a world champion boxer?
Oh, well, I kind of recognized I was going to be a world champion when I was a child.
Okay.
I don't know, it was something inside of me that I felt that one day I would be something great in the sport of boxing.
And in fact, you came into the gym, you took up boxing, and really as a very young person, you had to make some tough decisions to stick with boxing. Tell us a little bit more about that path that you chose.
Well, when I was about, I think, 14 years old, I was living with my grandparents, and my grandparents were devoted Jehovah's Witnesses. And the religion, they believed that boxing was a promotion of violence,
mm-hmm.
and that anybody that lived under my grandparents' roof that was a part of the religion shouldn't be boxing. So I was doing it for a while, and nobody really knew that I was doing it. But when the Kingdom Hall found out I was doing it, I was about 17, and they told my grandmother that I shouldn't be living under her roof and boxing. And she kind of told me I needed to quit or move out, but instead I kind of snuck around and kept boxing.
Okay. And you were boxing for Gary Powell at the time, or were you at that point getting ready to go professional?
I was still at Gary Powell, an amateur at the time when that situation happened. I was just a decorated amateur. I was winning like Golden Gloves and like tournaments, like downstate and stuff like that.
But you were really tearing through a lot of those tournaments, I remember, because you really brought your fight on. So at some point, you said you always knew you were going to be a world champion. At some point, this really kind of became real to you, right? So you're building up, you're a pro, and now you're lining up championship fights. Did that change your game at all? Did it change the way you approached your fights at all?
What happened with my grandparents?
No. Once you continued boxing, and you had to make a lot of sacrifices. So once you became a pro and you began to realize, I'm making my dreams come true. Did that change the way you trained, or did that change the way you fought once you realized that you're on this path to reaching your dreams?
Well, it did change the way I trained, because when I became a pro, we fought longer, more rounds, no headgear, smaller gloves. So I knew I would have to do more than I did in the amateurs to, you know, be successful in the sport. So I will work out a little harder. Like even to this day, like I have three sessions a day that I do. I run in the morning. Then I come home, I take a nap. Then around noon, I have to be at strength training. Then at nighttime, I go to like boxing training. So to be a professional, I knew it would be a lot harder, but my passion and the dream I had, I didn't mind the hard work.
So, you know, of course, whenever you step into the ring, and by the way, tell us when you won this world champ, the IBF World Championship. I know it was 2019, but when and where was it?
It was December 5th, 2019, after a two-year layoff, I want to say. I had came back and had like tune-up fights is what we call them. But I had took some time off of boxing because things wasn't going right in my career. But it was December 5th, 2019 in New York City. And I actually went to the fight as the opponent.
Yeah, you went as an opponent, but you came out?
A champion.
A champion. So you met your dream. You reached your dream. So, you know, whenever you step into that ring, of course, you put your life on the line. Physically, literally put your life on the line, right? But the business of boxing, I mean, that's notorious. I mean, that's really, really difficult business. And yet you started McGee's House of Champions. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, McGee House of Champions was something that I thought of years ago. And what made me think of it was how hard it was for me to get fights over the years. It was a small pool of women boxing, which is growing now, but it's still not as large as the men. But it was so hard for me to get fights, and I really didn't have nobody advocating for me. So I started McGee House of Champions so I can help the youth, mostly females, that can't get fights, so they don't know how to go about it. So that's kind of what McGee House of Champions is about, because when I came back with my title, I put like 8 female fights on one card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a lot. it was a busy card, but it was a fun card.
It
was a really fun. And actually, I remember at the weigh-ins, when we had the weigh-ins in Gary, when you had a fight, I think in Hammond.
Yeah,
with Hammond Civic Center. Yeah, the Hammond Civic Center. So, you know, you've got this great social media presence. It's a lot of fun to watch. And I really like watching the videos of your son, who also happens to have pretty good hand speed and pretty good foot speed. But tell us, how do you balance mommy Mary McGee and living as merciless Mary McGee? That's a challenge.
It is. I was just talking to my friend about that earlier, how I ended up going to sleep late last night because I worked out. I did my 3 workouts yesterday, but I had an extra workout in the pool because I was having a little trouble with my knee. So I do like a water workout some night. But I had to pick my son up and I had to give him a bath. I had to wash his hair. I had to feed him. Then he wanted me to watch a movie with him. And it's like I have to sometimes sacrifice a little bit of sleep, not all the time, but some days to spend time with my son.
Yeah, it's a challenge. So I know you mentioned your knee. So real quick, you had a fight coming up. You no longer are going to make that fight. But what can we expect to see next from Merciless Mary McGee? I mean, when do we get to see you back in action?
Well, Eddie Hearns had made a video the other day, which he's one of the biggest promoters in boxing right now, man or female. And he was saying that he's expecting me to fight Chantel Cameron in October. And she's a WBC world champion.
Wow.
So she's ranked number 1, I'm ranked number 2. So we're ranked like right beside each other in the world. So that's a fight I'm looking forward to. I mean, I was looking forward to my fight on August 20th, but I had a freak accident in the ring. It was water in the ring, and I end up slipping and kind of hurt my knee. Really bad.
So if people want to see Merciless Mary McGee in social media and that really fun presence you've developed, how do they find you?
Well, I'm Mary McGee, which McGee is spelled M-C-G-E-E, because some people like to say M-A, but it's M-C.
Okay.
McGee on Facebook, and on Instagram, on Instagram, is Mary McGee _ champion.
Roger that. So listen to this. Merciless Mary McGee, you're a great sport. Mm-hmm. You're a great champ. She's merciless, and she's from right here in Gary, Indiana, and she's got more championships to win. Thank you, Merciless Mary McGee, for joining us on Off Mic.
Mike, I thank you for having me. You've been such a privileged part of my career since the beginning.
Well, you give me a lot to be thankful for. We'll be back, everybody, with more. Thank you, Mary. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Gonzalez. So there can be no Olympics without running. That was kind of how the Olympics got started. But there are also 4 brand new sports in this year's Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games, including karate. So joining us now on Off Mic are Heather Hinderlong, who is a co-owner of the Extra Mile Fitness Company in Valpo. She has helped coach many runners in competitions with other athletes and with themselves when they try to get their own personal bests. We're also joined by Shihan Anthony Howard, who is a 8th degree black belt in Shorin Ryu Karate, and he's the owner teacher of DSK Flying Tiger School in Lake Station. Heather and Shihan, welcome to Off Mic. So Shihan Howard, have you been watching the karate competitions on the Olympics?
Yes, I missed a couple of them, but I watched one.
So what'd you think?
Yeah, it was great to see karate in the Olympics this year, because lately it's just been taekwondo, which taekwondo is good also, but I just thought we should be in there too. So I'm really proud.
Now, how long have you been training in karate?
It's been probably 32 years.
So we won't mention your age because nobody would believe it if they saw you anyway.
Okay.
but you've seen a lot. You've seen a lot of changes in karate. But this year, this is the introduction, and this competition has been divided into katas and kumite, or fighting. Help us out. Explain the difference between the katas and the kumite competitions.
Well, the kata is mainly Imaginary fighting, I put it like that. Imaginary fighting. So they're looking at nice stances, control, balance, and just face expression, and just trying to feel the kata while they're doing it. And Kumite is just basically fighting. We're not looking for knockouts. It's a point fighting. So we go head, body, not really looking for blood either, but it's looking for that speed and control.
So when you talk about so when I'm thinking of katas, it's best to imagine you're being attacked or you're defending yourself against these imaginary opponents because it gives you a whole different energy, doesn't it?
Right.
So is that, tell me about the kia, by the way, and what the kia means when we see that in katas and kumite.
Well, the kia is more energy. It's bringing that energy out and just really feeling. And like I said, the judges feel that kata and that imaginary fighting as the way you go through your kata and then make that loud kia. And that's where that power comes from. They know that you're really trying to break.
Yeah. So it's like, is it a way to focus that energy then?
Yes, you can focus that energy by breathing in and then just letting it out. It's like screaming.
Well, and really, they do a lot of screaming in those kata competitions. Pretty impressive, actually. So you work with a lot of people, and a lot of young people, and you always have. And they have all different abilities. So in your experience, what is it about karate training that helps these young kids really develop and grow?
Well, what we do is just focus on the outside, a way of life. So we balance on that, and then after that, just see where the kids are going. If they're going slow, we work on them differently than we work on the ones that's moving fast. That way the parents don't think we have favors. So they already know that this guy is better than the other one, so we have to work with him differently. But sooner or later, that person will get it if they stay there long enough. So it's a thing where the parents have to be involved also, where the kids don't give up.
And your school, again, is DSK Flying Tigers on Lake Station, and you've had schools in different places. But you keep that building pretty packed, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good thing. So what do you think happens next? So now that we have karate in the Olympics for the first time ever, do you think we'll see a lot more interest in karate among young people and adults? You think that's going to kind of spark something here?
Yes, I think weapons is going to come involved. Because these kids are doing weapons and they're doing flips just like gymnastics. I mean, with weapons in their hands. So I think they're going to really like that. Same way they brought the surfboard, not the surfboard, but the skating. Well, anyway, you know, the new sports that just came out. The skateboards. So that's in the Olympics because they do tricks and they're flipping
exactly.
With skateboards.
So
now you see weapons in kids' hands and doing flips. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. So we're also joined by Heather Handelong of Extra Mile. Are you with us?
Yeah. Hey, Michael. How are you?
Hey, Heather. Great. Thanks for joining us. So I can't help but get excited. I mentioned a minute ago that really the Olympics began with running.
It did.
You know, I really can't help but get excited every 4 years watching these running events in the Summer Olympics. You've been a runner for a long time. You've worked with other runners for a long time. So when you think about the Olympics, what does that do for runners? How does it pump you up? Does it raise the bar? What's the effect?
Well, I think because I feel like they rarely televise running events because it's hard to televise them. And with the marathon taking place this weekend and having marathons this year after COVID, I know everyone is excited to watch the marathon take place. And it's just exciting to be able to see the strategy of the pros and how they take on the marathon. And then as novelist runners or just your amateur runners, we try to implement the same type of process as we take on that challenge, whether it's running a 5K or a marathon. We get inspired because we see it on TV, you know. And how often do you see a running event on TV? So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, at least in the U.S., you really they have professional leagues around the world, but it's certainly a lot harder to watch here on TV in the U.S.,
Exactly. And it's amazing because you see, you know, all sorts of runners there. You see, you know, you got your 100 meter people and then you got your race walkers that did the 50K race walk. And so it shows that running is inclusive to all sorts of speeds, you know, and anyone can do it because all you got to do is put on a good pair of shoes and hit the roads and you can be out there mimicking what the Olympians do.
So Heather Hendelong, we've seen big jumps in people who run at different times. These sort of running crazes that kind of happen every few years. So when you see the level of interest rise during those times, is that similar to the level of interest rising during the Olympics?
I think it does. I think it gets people just excited to do it. So those people who may just run, you know, from their house and never enter a competition may decide, you know what, I may try a local 5K and support a charity that's near and dear to me and my heart and my community. And I think it gives people that encouragement that, hey, I can do that. And they're not as scared, you know, because they saw it happen on TV. Or they may have their kids join a track program from a local community or park district and say, you know, I think I want to see if my kid can do that. So I think you do see a spike in it when you have the Olympics every 4 years.
So we're talking with Heather Hendelong of Extra Mile Fitness Company, and we're also talking with Shehan Anthony Howard of DSK Flying Tigers. Running is the oldest Olympic sport, and karate is one of the four newest Olympic sports. So coming back, Heather Hendelong, at some point, every one of these athletes, or at least almost every athlete, probably incorporates running into their training. So whether you're training for a running event or you're training for some other type of event or even just for fitness, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it interesting? Because especially when you're these long training sessions going into a marathon, it can get a little tiring. So how do you keep people up?
Well, we have training groups, obviously, through the Extra Mile. And we also encourage people to just like switch it up. Like maybe not just go out for an easy 3 mile run. Maybe you break it up and do, you know, a minute a little bit quicker and then recover for a minute. Or maybe you go pick a scenic route and you go out to maybe the Prairie Duneland Trail, or you hit, you know, the Erie Lackawanna Trail over in Lake County, or over by Hammond where they have that beautiful bike path. So mix it up a little bit and just see what's out there. Or go run at the dunes, hit a trail, and that keeps people engaged so they don't get bored with just running from their house every day.
So what are you looking forward to? We got the marathon coming up. Are you making any predictions on that marathon?
Oh, the Olympics? Well, I think it's really exciting right now, like watching the men's 1500, because we have a local Indiana, you know, someone from Indiana that made the finals. And personally, I can't wait to see the men's 1500 finals and see Cole Hawker run. And, you know, I don't have a prediction for the marathon. I just like seeing how it unravels, you know, the strategy right in it and how they do that. And obviously we're going to root for, you know, USA in that. But it's great seeing the African nations compete in that field. It just is, and it's exciting watching everyone see how they take it on.
So, Shehan Anthony Howard, before I let you go, do you think we'll see the weapons in the next Olympics? Karate with weapons?
I really believe so.
Well, that'll be fun. So, Heather Hendelong of Extra Mile Fitness Company, Shehan Anthony Howard, DSK Flying Tigers. They spend a lot of time working with people who are new to their fields, as well as experienced runners and karate artists, so martial artists. So thank you both for your time, and thank you for joining us on Off Mic.
Okay,
thank you,
Michael.
Thanks for having us.
So thank you, everybody, for letting me join you for a few minutes. That's our show for today. You can hear this program again at lakeshorepublicradio.org or RG, or you can go to the NPR app. Thanks for listening. I'm on, again, Michael Gonzalez, sitting in for Michael Puente. I hope you have a great weekend.